It's rolling. So we are pulling out of your house. The first question I have is why not have street addresses and numbers?
I think because it's not our way.
Yeah.
To have them, and so we've pushed back about getting them because we know each other, we know who we are, we know. And if you don't know where you're going, oh, you're just next to that person, and her sister's cousin is, or we have nicknames too of our streets.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they have names, sort of, but they're kind of passed down or passed around from person to person as nicknames.
Like, we're on the highway right now. I don't know if you could tell. This is totally the highway.
Okay.
And we're going to pass Kane's Corner. This is Kane's Corner. So everybody just knows that.
Right. And it's like one of those if you have to ask kind of things.
Right, right.
Now,
giving directions to outsiders, that's tricky.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of, I don't know, that's where like a Google, you know, geolocating...
Which exists now.
Pin drop is very
easy,
very handy.
So this is the village, considered the village and the highway. Kind of the core of Ganawage. We have our library, a couple of churches. That's the United Church. Right here is our fire brigade. It's volunteer, but we have a couple full-time chief, fire chief and whatnot. This is Dodama's Cafe on the left, and it's our local coffee shop.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
Nice.
That might be a place to stop. They started with a lot of fruit infusions, like water infusions, cucumber, jalapenos, strawberries, mint, and they're doing a lot of teas now, cedar tea mixes, hibiscus, and of course they have the espresso bar. We passed the Knights of Columbus, so we have a Knights, a marina, a Legion Hall, and the Moose Lodge, all social hotspots.
Got it.
Where men could go to the office. And women.
Enjoy their companies. Good.
Yeah.
Also noticing the stop signs are in two languages.
Yep, Destan. Stop and Destan. There's a huge language revitalization happening right now in town. And little by little you're seeing more and more people use it. The town taking initiatives and making Ganyegeha signs.
That's the name of the language?
Yep, Ganyegeha.
What's the English name for that language?
Mohawk.
It's Mohawk. Yeah. So it's specifically to Mohawk. It's not a larger language group.
No. I mean, it could be Iroquois, but the Mohawk, there's a couple different Mohawk reses, and we speak the same, except it's tweaked a little bit.
Okay.
So if you go to a fluent speaker in Agwizasne or Ganasadage, you'll understand them, but there are pronunciations that are a little different, some words that are different.
Does Kanawake spread out much further than this, or is it kind of here centralized?
No, it does spread out quite a bit. I'd say there's about 5 different major other roads that, you know, branch off of the village, and down each of those roads, more bush, farmland, and people's houses that have more space.
Tiffany Deer and I are driving around Kanawage, Quebec, just across the St. Lawrence River from Montreal. Despite a few noticeable quirks, no street names or house numbers for starters, there seems to be a strong Mayberry vibe here. Broad streets and trim houses, and during this pre-COVID visit, a lot of exuberant Halloween decorations. Kanawage is Mohawk land, well-tended because, perhaps, it is so hard won. This town is home, first of all, to the Mohawk Skywalkers, those fearless iron workers who built and continue to build New York City's skyline. And it's very well known for having stood up to the Quebec government during the tense and sometimes violent standoff known as the Oka Crisis. Tiffany, my guide to the reserve and the guest on this episode, comes from a long line of Skywalkers, and she was there for the Oka Crisis as a child. That is to say, she is deep in the culture and the history here, and for her, food is at the heart of it all. Tiffany and I sat in her kitchen. We drank strawberry medicine that she prepared. We talked about Mohawk cooking in the time before salt and about the tense showdowns with white Montreal of her childhood. A warning, I probably pronounce Kahnawake about 5 different ways in this episode, which is to say I have as much to learn as ever here. But I so appreciate Tiffany's good humor and generosity of spirit to help me start on the path. This is Nathan Thornburg, and from Roads and Kingdoms, you are listening to The Trip, drinking with exceptional people around the world. Let's start and talk about this amazing looking drink that you've made.
Okay, cheers. This is strawberry drink.
Cheers.
You'll notice you do have to chew, which is a fun part of the strawberry drink. This is strawberries are one of our medicines. And this drink is mashed up strawberries, and you can sweeten it with any sweetener. I used maple syrup. And this is the drink that you would share with any celebration, traditional festival. And one of our favorites at powwows.
It's amazing. It's incredibly delicious. Could not think of a simpler drink, and is like, but it's so good. Like, what would you do to it otherwise? Even from the name on down, it's like, it's strawberry drink. there's no pretensions about it. It's just really, really delicious strawberries.
I'm going to give you a tip. When you're making your strawberry drink, freeze your berries.
Okay.
When it's defrosted, it'll smash better and it has a better consistency.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll put a little like a strawberry drink recipe in the notes for Tiffany Deer's strawberry drink. And, you know, when you say medicine, and I guess we can kind of get into that a little bit in talking about Mohawk food in particular, or indigenous food more broadly, but how should a settler like myself understand like the connection between food and medicine? Because, you know, this is when you buy this in a, you know, supermarket, you are not going down the medicine section. It's the fruit or vegetable, right?
Right. Well, it's what Mother Earth has given us here that'll help and nourish our bodies and our minds. So strawberries, for one, any one of the berries grown here and around, we're definitely focusing on local food right now, right? So for myself as well, trying to better educate myself and what I know inside, like reaching back to that ancestral knowledge, trying to use what's here, what we've grown, what we used to have, and that being our medicine.
Right. So it's almost like not a different relationship to food than non-Indigenous people have, but it's the way of thinking about what it's doing. Because whether or not we are aware of it, you know, the food that we eat outside of Indigenous culture is our medicine. It does affect our health and our bodies. And maybe we just have this very dim beginning of an understanding that that's true. But for you, it's in the language about how you talk about food. It's like, this shit is pharmaceutical, right?
Yeah. It's the connection. It's the connection to our Mother Earth, right? Like, we've grown it, and then what it gives us. It's like a gift from the Creator. And if you keep that in mind, then that connection, you have that bond with the food. And it's more than just flavor.
Right. Mm-hmm. And such a, you know, our mad dash to just maximize the sweet and salt and crisp and crunch. I was doing as much as I could try to get some insight into what Mohawk cuisine and food was like. One of the things that really stuck out to me actually was that salt was not a part of traditional Mohawk cooking, and that's sort of stunning to me, because salt is of course one of the great joys of life and also one of the great killers of man, you know, in these days. But I guess the palate would have been quite different, right? If you're talking about food that isn't salted or even really spiced heavily in that way.
Yeah, when you haven't grown up with something, then you know you're not missing it. But once it is in your life, the lack thereof, it's quite noticeable. And a lot of times with my catering company, people would want traditional food. And I,
you know, and I have to take it with a grain of salt, pun, because the food would be quite bland and boring if I did date it back 300 years ago to what we had, you know, right, and what we were working with.
How much authenticity are you ready to stomach? Huh?
Right. So really it's fusion. Mm. You know what I mean? What I'm producing now, what a lot of us are making and calling traditional food.
Right. So here we are right in the heart of Kanawake and we're just a stone's throw from a Mexican restaurant. You said everybody's crazy about Mexican food because once they discovered salt and spice and flavor, then of course, like, you know, you kind of gravitate toward it, and maybe even the Mohawks wouldn't be ready for the full cuisine of yesteryear.
Right.
So how would you define Mohawk cooking in that context, and how did it work with, you know, with the catering that you've done and the cooking that you do?
Well, in my mind, there's two separate baskets of native food or Mohawk food, and one basket would be filled with our traditional food, which to me, what I grew up with, it's meat pie, chicken and dumplings, the mashed potatoes, sweet potatoes, pumpkin pie, turkey. And when somebody says they're having a wedding or an anniversary or a baby shower, oh, what are you serving? Oh, traditional. You know, automatically, you know, that's your lineup. That's what you have to look forward to. And that's incredible. It's delicious. But the other basket would be like traditional food of our people. Right, not what we're consuming today, but what we used to consume yesteryear, and that would be the Hubbard squash, the Three Sisters corn, beans, and squash, a lot of game.
Right.
Yeah.
Which around here, what's that comprised?
So it would be a lot of fish because we're right on the water, and then deer, I'm sure rabbit.
Mm-hmm. The Three Sisters is interesting because that's a concept that comes up a lot in Mexico. I mean, I guess all of the Americas have this, it's a way of planting, right? Where you, plant your squash and then the beans over it. And yeah. For me, it's a through line, I guess, between the foods, and we're kind of joking about Mexican being super popular here, but
that's why. I mean, there's a connection.
Yeah.
Relate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. These are not like totally foreign concepts, I would imagine.
Yeah.
How do you, when you're talking to people about that difference between, I don't know, it's interesting. I'm trying to put it in the context of like, you know, a white family or something, they grew up with like Taco Tuesdays, and maybe that for them feels like the food of their family, you know, or like mm-hmm. the stuff that people cook when they get together because it's what they grew up cooking, versus like, yeah, how far back you go. I was in Ireland and talked with an Irish chef who was, you know, had done some work to like dig up the old cookbooks of a couple hundred years ago, and was saying that one recipe you would just say first chop the heads off of 100 herons and then pickle them, and you know, for any Irish person today is just like absolutely stomach turning to think of the mass slaughter, and then pickling a bird seems real strange. And
yeah,
so that kind of, you know, that difference between comfort food and like that traditional authentic, I mean, how do you find those recipes for one? Like where do you go to get a sense of like that really old cooking of the Mohawk people?
Right. So that's the work that I'm doing now, is to try to dig up that kind of information. But in the past, I've just used what's in my heart and what's in my mind and thought about, you know, gave it a little bit of thought about what would I have eaten, prepared 200 years ago, 300 years ago. And today, making traditional fare, fusion, Mohawk cuisine, I just want to pull in flavors that are staples to us, like the squash, the beans, the corn, sage, cedar, berries, beautiful berries. And then when I can get my hands on wild game, that's definitely, you know, playing. But then again, spicing the wild game, in the past, it would be really quite bland.
Yeah.
Yeah. nowadays I'll totally spice it up.
Yeah, you don't mind.
I'll season.
You don't mind branding it. You're not betraying anyone in your in your lineage. I mean, that's kind of interesting though, because it sounds like it's almost for you a thought experiment of walking in someone else's shoes to try and come up with. And I'm sure it doesn't stop at the plate then you're probably also taking you down a lot of roads like, oh Christ, like what is it, what would it have been like to be Tiffany 200 years ago?
Which is a fun trip to take.
You get to kind of think about it. I mean, yeah, that's not a thought exercise or experiment I do. I mean, every once in a while I'll see a Hasid, which is essentially what my, you know, great-great-grandfather looked like. Uh-huh. And I'll think, oh man, that's a trip, huh? That could be me. That was me back in the shtetl. But that's as far as it goes. But for you, this was part of your life and career was trying to imagine what it would have been like to cook and feed families in that way.
I've certainly interviewed and asked a bunch of elders and family members what they consider traditional food, you know, what their favorite things to serve is to help build a bigger, you know, menu.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What are their responses when you come to them with a question like that? Like, what do they tell you?
Well, corn soup is huge. Usually everybody says corn soup, but I didn't really grow up too much with corn soup. My dada made it, but my mother didn't make it at home.
Okay.
Boiled dinner.
Your dada is grandmother?
Yeah, it's my mother's mother.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. So it's funny because growing up, my mom cooked comfort food, like, you know, regular everybody all over the world comfort food.
Right.
So even for me, my father wasn't a hunter. My mother wasn't a hunter. I've never had wild game when I was young that I knew of. So it really is kind of an education for myself as well.
Right.
Yeah.
And now you were saying earlier, your dude is big into fishing. His brother's a hunter. And that almost, does that make a big difference in the life of a you know, a Mohawk cook almost, of having that direct access to those ingredients?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Very exciting. We went hunting last weekend. And I had the baby in a carrier, and our 2-year-old, you know, was walking with us or on his back, and Paul had his gun. We saw a deer. He could have taken the shot, but instead he turned back to make sure we saw the deer. And by the time he turned around, you know, to aim, it had taken off. But
that's a great metaphor for being a parent. You're just like, am I teaching in this moment? Oh shit, the moment's passed.
Yeah, but really, we were out for a family walk. Thanksgiving walk with the gun, and to think if he had gotten it, like, that's a lot of work.
Yeah.
To gut it, to quarter it. We had to go to this island by boat, so we were all in this little boat. I mean, it's definitely the experience that I'm looking for, you
right.
know, and we're probably going to go again next weekend. Maybe not take the baby, leave the baby with his mother, but it's new for me. I've never processed an animal, like, from death to table.
Yeah, it's intense. The little parts I've done with it, I've been involved with it. It's intense, and I guess it taps into something for me that is very eye-opening. I can imagine that it kind of has a lot more roots in your thinking, and you know, especially since you have been interested and obsessed with this cuisine for such a long time, and that's such a staple of that act of doing it. I can imagine the synapses firing, you know.
Yeah, I'm really excited.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I'm sure there are a lot of other qualities about your man, but just having that proximity to, like, let's get some fish and game.
Yeah,
it's gonna be a big selling point.
Yeah,
right on. When you talk to people in terms of, like, you know, elders and people who might have had some exposure, was their diet in their lifetimes, you know, 50 years ago, did it feel different, or has it been, are we kind of in this, you know, this kind of Taco Tuesday culture for a while in terms of the way that people eat?
Thinking about my mother's experience growing up, she was of 9 kids, and her father had died young. When she was probably 3. So it was my dada raising 9 children on her own. Ages, she was pregnant at the time. And the eldest, my Auntie Veronica, was probably 12. So they grew up pretty poor. So what I know of my mother's, she said my dada always had a huge plate of food. Like she always prepared enough for the family, be it big pots of soup when she'd make cornbread and steak, you know, lots more cornbreads compared to the steaks. Everybody got a couple of pieces, you know, a couple of bites of steak. But she didn't grow up starving, but they did grow up poor. Mm. Now, what she grew up with was like stews, you know, boiled dinner, which is any kind of root vegetables and beans that you can get your hands on, boil it with a pigtail or two, you know, and then make dodda bread, which is just mixing flour, some baking soda, salt, milk, and frying it in your cast iron.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So, right. And I guess that's also, that's a big part of the cuisine too. And this is where like fry bread comes from and so on. It's like the Italian style of like poverty cuisine, essentially, that this food has been shaped by periods of intense scarcity. So that would have been, I mean, that would have been throughout the last few centuries, at least, of Mohawk cooking. It just would have gotten down to the most basic stuff of like, yeah, let's a stew we can put root vegetables in. Sounds like translatable even in the hardest times.
Right.
Huh. When you go back and think, I mean, I guess that would sort of color this too, but if you're in these kind of thought exercises of, you know, me as a mother and provider and cook 200 years ago in the way that, you know, the Mohawk community was then, is there any part of you who's like, I would enjoy that more? Like I was meant to be in that life and not this one. Do you ever think that? Or you?
I do. No, yeah. I do. Absolutely. And I would, I do fantasize about going back because I think that I'd be really great at it. I was devastated when I realized I needed glasses, and this was in grade 6, because I thought I was going to be a hunter. I thought I was, you know, a bow and arrow, and I was meant to do that. But then you can't be a hunter when you can't see far. You know what I mean? Like, I think I haven't tried it with my glasses off, but
that would be some real forces with you stuff if you were out there just slaying deer and a very nearsighted child.
Blindfolded, yeah. So I knew, you know, my passion was with my hands, what I could do in front of me, children, food, crafts, which is what I'm reveling in right now.
Right. Right. I guess that's part of the answer to it too, is like wherever your heart is guiding you seems to be skills that might have been useful back then. Mm-hmm. I remember we spent some of the summer teaching my son how to shoot and cook iguanas.
Iguanas?
Yeah, we have like where I'm from in the Keys, we have this infestation of non-native iguanas, and you know, Guatemalans and Mexicans and Trinidadians eat them, and so I got really interested in kind of shooting and eating them. And you know, listen, it's not the best meat on earth, and butchering a lizard is a huge lizard is a really troubling experience.
I imagine.
But one of the things I was like, I was very proud of myself. This is very self-serving. I was very proud of myself for having taught my son something that was both, you know, a skill that would have been really great maybe like 200 years ago, or in the Keys, you know, 150 years ago when it was pretty wild still. And then also will be great for the apocalypse that's coming. You
Absolutely.
Know?
I mean, anything could be eaten.
Right.
You know, and if you know how to flavor it, if you know the tricks of slow and low, or, you know, make it tender, that's the good education right there of knowing that knowledge.
I did overcook the shit out of it. One, I was a little afraid of the meat, so I cooked it too much. So yeah, I need to get back down there and get another one.
Get another shot. My man, Paul, grew up eating muskrat.
Mm.
Yeah. So they also trap muskrat a lot, but I've not had one yet myself, but apparently there's like a very musky smell about it.
Makes
on these
sense.
Muskrats. Yeah. But it's a rat. It's a forest rat.
It is a forest rat.
Mm-hmm. But and it's a delicacy to him now. Like he wants me to learn. And I said, okay, go get me some muskrats and I'll cook it.
And you're ready.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that's also like, I remember when, this is slightly off piste, but I remember when it was like Ted Turner had started to do these bison restaurants. He was trying to make bison meat. And the thing that I thought was a little aberrant about the project, I think there were some good intentions behind it, but he was breeding these bison to taste the most like beef, right? To breed the flavor out of it.
That's a head slapper right there.
A head slapper is, that's a perfect way of saying it. Because it's like, at some level, like Paul with his muskrats, like that difference in flavor is something that's actually valuable. Like, you want to go out and get that, and he's not going to be able to find that in the grocery store in that kind of like that context. Like, it tastes a little different. You should celebrate that on some level.
Right.
So they're not breeding the musk out of the muskrats just yet around here.
I don't think so.
Okay. Fair enough.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
So when you would do catering, like what for you were some of these dishes where you, that kind of mentality of mixing new with, you know, new flavor demands with old styles? Like, give me an example of a dish where that worked really well for you.
Sure. Well, in my catering that I do, a lot of it is geared for indigenous events. So they're calling me because they want to provide an indigenous flavor. But then I also have the other side of catering where I'm catering big movie productions. And when you cater a movie production, there's kind of a layout of what you have to provide. Now, the fun that I get to do is throwing in, you know, my flavor. And a lot of it is butternut squash. Hmm. It's not the squash that would have been local and native to here. It would be that big Hubbard, but sometimes it's hard to get your hands on a Hubbard. Hmm. And a butternut squash, that big long neck, there's a lot of good squash meat in there. So number one, if I threw squash in it, boom, like I would call it
native. That's awesome. Yeah. So it's like a little shorthand, a little something just to let you know that next to the cheese cubes and the sliced melon that you need to have for your movie catering, here's a squash dish. And now how important is it to you that, you know, that the key grip knows that he's eating something that's got a little native touch to it?
It's pretty important to me.
Yeah.
I like to put it out there. Yeah.
So you put it on a sign.
Yeah. Or like, I'm standing in front of it. By the way, this is, you know.
You are now entering unseated catering territory. Yeah. Okay.
And then for the catering jobs that they specifically hired me to do native flavors, smoked sturgeon would be my first call to try to get my hands on smoked sturgeon. And luckily, it's Paul's brother, Danny Boy, and he'll take a huge order. He's got the best smoked sturgeon in Upper Bessemer.
His name is Danny Boy. That's amazing.
I don't think it's on his birth certificate, but everybody knows him as Danny Boy.
Danny Boy. Yeah. I've heard it. I've heard it in the songs. Got it. So he's got the hookup with the sturgeon.
Yeah. I mean, they go nightlining and Paul's grew up helping him his whole life. And then right from pulling in these gigantic sturgeons from the water, you know, gutting them, heads off. Actually, yeah, it is heads off. The brine overnight. And then to smoke it, it's an all-day process.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how do you use it? What does it end up? Where does it end up in the plate?
I'd say it's like smoked salmon, where I would slice it nice and thin. It's dry, but red on the outside and white on the inside, wow, the sturgeon becomes. And it's got this incredible smoky, it's very like oily, so it's very rich. Yeah, it's delicious. Serve that with a nice like aged cheddar, some crackers or beautiful bread.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's not meant to be like a fillet just eaten like a chicken breast. It's enjoyed.
The Jewish half of me is very, the synapses are firing.
Oh, you would love.
I've now found the Venn diagram between Mohawk and Ashkenazi desires is like definitely around the smoked sturgeon. That sounds amazing. But it's hard to get your hands on, and yeah.
Yeah. And Danny Boy has to be available.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. And it's not the same. I mean, I guess that's true of like you were saying with the Hubbard squash, just the supply chain isn't there yet, mm-hmm, right? To be able to do this with great regularity or without substituting ingredients like that.
Right.
So it's got to be butternut instead of Hubbard squash. But, and what are some other ones that that you feel like, well, you know, this is what's available. It's the closest proximity to a Mohawk ingredient that we might have.
Cornbread and steak. Mm-hmm. So the cornbread is made with cornmeal, corn flour. I put oatmeal in mine and kidney beans. And you mix it with hot water. You form like a patty or a puck. And then that's boiled. So the cornbread, it's not like a Southern style baked cornbread. It's a boiled cornbread. It's really dense, but not too dense. And you serve that with sausages and steak and gravy. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's using store-bought ingredients, essentially.
Unless you're a hunter and your freezer's full of venison or moose meat, you know, so that would be your gravy, your meat.
Right. And you said here in Kanawake, that's the kind of Sunday feast that everybody has is cornbread and steak.
Yeah.
And that's a beef steak because you can't go to the messy kitchen or a restaurant and get wild game on the regular.
Not yet.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's like on Sunday, everybody comes out, they will go to the restaurant or cafe of choice.
Or make it in your kitchen.
Or you can make it at home.
Yeah.
And how is it? Is it like is it a communal thing? Is it, or like how is it presented? I guess the cornbread and steak, is it like, I don't know, the center of a big table or
definitely eaten best surrounded by friends and family.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, platters and help yourself and everything's in a big bowl. But you're going out to get it, it's per plate. You have your one cornbread, your two sausages, your piece of steak and your gravy.
Wow.
All plated.
That is meat.
It's a heavy, it's a heavy, awesome meal that is supposed to last you the rest of the day.
You know, it's interesting because I, when reading a little bit about Mohawk cuisine, I think there's been some times where people have, you know, focused on the Three Sisters and on the local produce kind of vibe that comes with the cooking. And which feels to me at least like a big counterweight to the kind of lumberjack food that Quebec is known for, right? Which is just like pig ears and maple syrup and, you know, and all put on a giant plate. So is that a part of, you know, when you talk about Mohawk cooking? Because obviously Mohawks are meat intensive and, you know, hunting wild game was always part of the culture. But is there an aspect of it where you can say, hey, you know, particularly here in Quebec, like it doesn't all have to be meat pie. Like there's a better way.
Yeah, sure. I mean, a lot of my catering too was one of my mandates or my personal goals was to try to eradicate diabetes in our communities and with our people. So for a couple of years, I was really pushing tons of veggies, salad forward meals, you know, with a token protein, clean protein. But,
you lost that battle.
Well,
there's a pause there. It's like, and then I was driven out of town.
No,
I only got to come back last year.
It's funny because the education of health, you know, it's everywhere and it's here too. And everybody's making strides to become healthier. But we're still a people who love comfort food and bread and butter, pastas. So it is kind of slow on some levels, but in others, people are definitely a lot more gardens, you see. People are gardening, and a lot of people are raising their own animals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's a dynamic, whether here or anywhere across the state, certainly, where the luxury, the privilege of caring about your health is, I don't know how it can be switched so that that's not the dynamic, but it's true. Like it's a great luxury to be able to care about those things and not to just immediately go for
survival.
Yeah. And something satisfying because life's a little rougher than you'd like and you go for the butter or whatever it is that, and you know, it takes a certain amount of focus and leisure to be able to say like, now I'm really going to watch what I'm doing. I don't know. It's just always, even in our own communities down in the States where you can just tell the people who are super fit generally and are eating real well and feeling themselves like are generally just rich and they've got probably reasons that aren't that great for why. And, you know.
Yeah, I hear you. When you have the luxury to focus on that. Uh-huh.
But maybe there's, I mean, I guess there's a counter narrative here, at least in terms of awareness, where you can say, actually, the most Mohawk thing you could do would be to be planting your own little garden here and have a squash heavy diet or something.
Right.
So that people can have some other way of engaging and thinking like, oh yeah, this fits in. Like maybe this is the comfort food that we didn't know that we used to have or something.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting. So tell me the name. It's Gui Gui is the name of the catering.
Yeah, it's Gui Gui Gourmet.
Gui Gui Gourmet. What does that mean?
It means, hey, hi.
Hey, not bonjour, hi.
No.
Just hey, hi.
Segu is the more formal way to say a greeting.
Okay.
But Gui Gui is like, hey, yay.
I can see the match now. I get it. That is a good name for any catering you would come and bring out into the world. And now Messy Kitchen, which has been ratified by you as the spot to come and eat in town, they're doing a lot of the catering as well.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You had mentioned catering for movie sets and your sister's a director, and we were just saying before we started to talk about her new movie and that you and your kids were extras in it. I think it's super fascinating. It's also, you know, I think a big part of the story of this community is the Oka crisis, which was 1990.
Yep.
Can you give me the just like very brief like rundown of what that was? And because you lived through it. As a child, and then what it was like kind of reenacting that.
Sure. So the Oka crisis happened when I was 10 years old, and it was about a sacred pines area in Gunasadage, which is another Mohawk reserve about an hour and 15 minutes from here. And there is a golf course that's bordering these very old pines, and the golf course wanted to extend and make a 9-hole into an 18-hole, which they would have to cut down a big piece of this sacred pine area land. And so the people there their foot down.
I'm already mad. I mean, yeah. From 9 to 18 holes is really a holy mission. But Jesus Christ. Okay.
And the contractors, you know, they weren't stopping. So vocally, nothing was happening. So they took our people took a hard stance and put up blockades, like turned over cars and just made a barrier saying you're not going to cut these trees and you're not going to encroach on this traditional land. And to brother up with them, Ganawage, which is an hour and a half away, but you know, there are our other Mohawk reserve, we're brother and sisters. We blocked the Mercier Bridge, which is a major, major highway connecting South Shore to the island of Montreal. So that made major headlines.
Right.
And we blocked it completely for, I don't remember exactly how many days, but it was like 2 or 3 months. So really the world kind of stopped at that point. I mean, the highways weren't running the same. There were helicopters all over the sky. The military and the army is here.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really intense. I mean, you're not worried about going to work every day anymore. Like, really, life kind of stopped, and it was all about this crisis, right? And taking a stand and being strong.
And one of the unique things about this town is that you're the place where the pain can be put onto Montreal, because you're right across the river. You control the bridge.
Yeah.
You know, it's in your area. So even though it's happening up in Oka, and you know, you were the ones who could be and had to be the kind of pointy end
we
of the
brought
spear.
Brought the story.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Big time, for sure. So living it was kind of exciting for me as a kid. It was like being in an action movie. I don't remember being that scared, except if I saw my mom scared or nervous or stressed out, you know, then I felt it a little bit. But otherwise, the highways were bare. We were biking anywhere you wanted to bike. There were food bank halls, you know, set up around town. So me and my sister would go and pick out supplies, because your regular grocery stores, like, food wasn't coming in the same way as before. People were more neighborly. You're borrowing stuff. And then your rat race, the typical rat race lifestyle kind of stopped. It was like super summer vacation.
Yeah.
So this is my memory, but
yeah,
beyond a 10-year-old, you know, and I was very positive and optimistic, still am, but beyond that, it was a very real situation and very traumatic. So the bridge crossing, when a lot of women, children, elders decided to leave town because there was rumors that the army would come in and then it might get violent, but everybody had a gun, right? Like our warriors were standing right, strong and ready. So many, many people decided to leave, and we formed a convoy to cross the bridge. You know, our side opened it up, and it ended up taking many hours for the other side, which was controlled by the army and the Sûreté du Québec, probably. It took them a long time. We waited on the bridge all day. And then when they finally opened it up, there was a huge angry mob on the other side.
Of Québécois.
Yeah, yeah. Yelling awful things and hatred and throwing rocks. So that became very real, very quick for me. And my experience, it definitely was a formative time of my sister's life. She was 12. Our car was pelted with rocks, and one came through the back window. It was me and two cousins crouching down. I remember my mom screaming like, "Get down, get down, get down," you know, and she's crying and screaming, and then the window breaks and we're covered in glass, and you just hear the anger, wow, you know, outside the windows. So by the time we had a bunch of cars lined up, I don't remember how many, but at least 40, 50 cars.
Convoy. To evacuate from town.
Yeah. And each car basically had as many people as you can fit in them, in the big town cars, you know, of 1990. We were leaving town because the threat of invasion from the army, it was rumored that they would come in. And we didn't know how violent it would become. A lot of us were holding very serious weapons and guns. So,
and already there was the Warrior Society was the kind of self-defense group, they were here to defend.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And the idea that the army would come in, there could be, and there had already been a death or two, I think.
Yes. Right?
So that's the moment for you when it wasn't summer vacation. It got scary and serious and.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this caravan of cars got onto the bridge, and then what happened?
We waited on top of the bridge, which is kind of a surreal experience when you're crossing it your whole life and now you're playing on it, you know, throwing rocks down and seeing the different perspective.
Because it was still blockaded and you
right,
couldn't just go across.
Right. It was still blockaded. Yeah. Both sides.
How long did you spend there?
I think about 4 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. On the bridge. Yeah. And then when it was time, it was a slow process. You know, now we have a bunch of cars and we're driving slowly. So it wasn't like we could speed past this gathering mob that had, you know, gathered on the other side. It was, we kind of crawled through them.
So you got met by an angry mob of Québécois people on the other side.
Yeah.
Who now, after a couple months of having the bridge down and...
And a lot of hate, a lot of, inconvenience.
For all of the reasons that the whole thing started, like that had not been solved.
Right.
So that was what do you remember about going through the mob there?
It was really scary. My mother was screaming for us to get down. I did peek over the window because I'm a kid. So I had to see what was going on. And you just saw a ton of people, men, women, children. Well, not children, but they were standing on... big piles, like the road being turned up, you know, like the gravel.
Like asphalt. Had just been like...
Yeah, mounds. Yeah. Mounds of asphalt. And they were just throwing all different sizes, pieces at our cars.
Wow.
Yeah.
Knowing that, having it very obvious that these were elderly children, women, right, basically going through. So this affected you, obviously, and your sister was a little bit older. Mm-hmm. And she was 12 then?
She was 12.
Okay, so now, how many years down? We're almost 30 years past.
Yeah.
She is making a movie that you have taken part in. What's the scope of the movie? What's it about?
It's basically a coming-of-age story of a 12-year-old girl and how this changed her life. So my sister... well, the main character is basically loosely based on her. And Beans has a younger sister.
Okay, Beans is her main character. That's the name of the movie, too,
yeah.
Beans.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, and the younger sister, her name is Ruby, in it. Kind of based on me.
How are you liking Ruby as what you're seeing?
So I met her once, and she's actually my friend's daughter, and I almost cried because it was like looking through a time machine. I saw myself so much in this little actress, but I met her being herself, like not on set, not acting. She's bubbly and so enthusiastic. And like when I said, "You're kind of playing me when I was a kid," and she was like, "Wow," you know, and bouncing off the walls. And I related to her so much immediately.
Oh, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. But then not just your kind of on-screen you, but the actual you now with your kids, you played a part in it.
Yeah, we were extras on the day where we had the bridge. Tracy did not block the bridge for this scene. It was already being construction was happening. So one lane, one whole side of the bridge was already closed. So they utilized that. But regardless, we had all the old cars on the bridge. I mean, we had it completely set up with the old barricade. There was army, all our cars, all the women. So a lot of the cars passing on the other side. I mean, they were waiting in tons of traffic, which always happens when the Mercy has construction on it. But now they're yelling.
Oh no!
You know, either seeing the cameras and knowing it's a production and being like, "Whoa, cool," or the opposite. F you, and you know, like
yelling the same shit. Yeah, that they yelled at you in 1990.
Right. There were moments being an extra, and now I'm a mother, and I had my four kids with me. It was a completely different experience being a mother, trying to protect her kids, and living through that. And Tracy had, you know, the actors of they were army, they had their guns, and one of them searched our car, so we had to keep repeating it, you know, because you do takes over and over again. But there were moments where my heart was racing, and I know now when you're in this industry where you recreate traumatic events, it is important to have people to talk to afterward,
yeah.
You know, and have that in place just in case.
In case you're re-traumatized.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, I'm sure it lends credibility and authenticity to the portrayal that you and your kids did, but that's tough stuff. Having gone through it, and I'm sure for your sister to, you know, spend this year of her life or however long it's taken to make the movie of just diving into those kind of tough moments.
Right. Yeah, she's so strong. Such an amazing storyteller.
You had worked with her on a prior show too.
Yeah, she had a TV show on television for 5 seasons, and it was called Mohawk Girls.
Mm-hmm.
And I catered just about every season.
Nice.
Yeah.
And that was kind of interesting to me. And it, for me, it feels like this is what makes it the family's work in a way of you and her. And maybe there are others in the family who've been doing this, but it's kind of this like soft power, right? I mean, Mohawk Girls is a way, at least from my understanding of what the show was, seemed like it was a way to kind of humanize and really bring people into the internal lives of these young Mohawk women who, you know, then get to be shown as regular people with the same struggles and interests and desires as outside.
Yeah.
Which is so oppositional to this, like, you know, fuck you, you're blocking the bridge, or, you know, this kind of combative relationship that I think had its worst expression back then. Do you feel like that's part of the work when you talk about Mohawk food with your show? Because you also had a cooking show. I was talking about cooking Mohawk food. Are you just doing it because this is what you're interested in, or is there a larger kind of mission to that can help the white world outside understand what the hell is going on?
I think there's multiple levels and layers to what I do and why I'm doing it, basically. Like I have a passion, number one, to create delicious food. Two, I'm a native Mohawk woman, and my interest in how to use what we had and introduce that to the larger world where it will be beautiful, plated, delicious. You know, that is definitely my future goal, to open up a restaurant and serve only, you know, my fusion and what we're growing here. And of course, Danny Boy sturgeon. But
yeah, no, you were answering it actually right on the nose. But that's interesting that you say you said delicious twice in there, which makes it different than kind of like a pure, you know, kind of activistic or academic approach. Like you actually, the work is to make it taste really good, and then all the good things will kind of come from that.
Yeah, use what we have, what we can get our hands on. Because, for example, Paul says, oh, I don't like venison. So he's not that interested in getting a deer. And I was like, oh, please get the deer and I will show you delicious. You know what I mean? It's what you're exposed to. It's what you can't try something once and say, oh, I hate that. You know, you have to try it seven different times from seven different chefs and cooks and mothers. And because there's 1,001 ways to cook, create recipes and change.
Yeah. I mean, this is still one of the best things about food is you want to talk about behavior modification or changing the way that you think about other people or something. Deliciousness is just like a broad avenue that you can drive down to any kind of good goal of understanding something. I mean, if there was like just kick-ass Mohawk restaurants in the middle of Montreal, it feels like that would make a difference in the relationship, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's the goal then.
That's the goal.
Okay.
It's at least the 10-year goal because I do have babies.
That is true. Right. There's more babies to have.
Yeah. And I'm definitely focusing right now. There's no way I could do both. I tried for a while and I can't. I can't be the excellent chef that I want to be and be the excellent mother and raise my family the way I want to be.
Yeah.
So I'm lucky enough basically to be able to step away from cooking.
Yeah.
Like that catering.
It feels like that's not, they're not wholly unrelated, right? This is all a personal mission of yours and taking care of people and feeding them and doing it in the home context. And then when they can tie their own shoes enough, right, and make their own venison, then you can go out and bring this message. Well, I'm very excited. I will be there lined up for first service at Tiffany Deer's new restaurant to be named at a later date. And cannot thank you enough for talking with me. It's been so much fun.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Miawa.
You've been listening to The Trip from Roads and Kingdoms. Alexa Van Sickle is our producer. Music by Dan the Automator. Episode illustration by Daisy D. Show artwork by Adele Rodriguez. Executive producers are me and Matt Goulding, also of Roads and Kingdoms. Next week, it's my old friend, Montreal native Jody Ettenberg. She spent years traveling the world, writing smartly about life on the road, gaining a large and devoted following along the way. And then a rapid succession of medical calamities struck, and one of the world's great independent travelers now has to battle just to stand upright for any amount of time. It's an intense conversation about freedom and frailty with one of the most insightful people I know. We will meet you there.